You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us. When you think of punk music, you probably imagine some mohawk leather, some studs, maybe the forever shirtless Iggy Pop, Iggy and the Stooges. You think of it as a gateway to some innocent teenage rebellion. A new book put out by translator, music journalist, and former Berlin-based DJ Tim Moore argues that, at least in the 1980s Berlin, the punk aesthetic was inherently political. Titled Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall, the book charts punk's development from a music and fashion style to embodying the kind of freedom of expression that was denied in the GDR and which ultimately laid the groundwork for the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, which was 29 years ago from today. Very happy to welcome Tim to studio. Hi, Tim.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
So you first came to Berlin in 1992, and you admitted you showed up there kind of a stupid American. You thought it was Oktoberfest, and where's my beer?
Totally clueless. Yeah, I thought I'd get off the plane, and people would have those giant one-liter beers, and it'll be a lot of lederhosen. And instead, I ended up in one of these typical high-rise East Block housing blocks, you know, with just 20 buildings that all look the same. And it was a surprise. And but fortunately, I pretty quickly found my way into the scene that was exploding at in the eastern part of the city. A lot of the central parts of East German cities had been pretty well destroyed during the war, and they tended to build up around the edges rather than refurbish the central parts. And so after the fall of the wall, the central parts became this kind of playground. They were setting up the first clubs and bars and galleries and all the things we associate with Berlin now. And I just landed in that world by coincidence, basically, and started DJing there.
And as you started to learn more, when did you have the inkling that there's a book here? There's a story to be told here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up with the typical sort of Reagan America narrative about the end of the Cold War, that East German or East European kids wanted Levi's and hamburgers and pop music and all that, and Reagan had said tear down the wall, and the wall came magically down. But even though I was skeptical about that narrative, I didn't really have any concrete evidence to the contrary until I started to meet people in East Berlin who'd been involved in the political underground. And so all these clubs and bars and everything where I was hanging out, it turned out to be most of them had been founded by former members of the East German punk scene. And eventually, once I became friends with some of them, they showed me things like one guy had a folder he'd kept under a false drawer bottom during the dictatorship that had some lyric scraps and photos of him and his friends. And I realized, these are the people who actually fought the dictatorship. You know, a lot of them had gone to jail and been beaten and interrogated. And so I thought, this is a story I really want to tell at some stage.
Before we get into that, I do want people to get a sense of your writing. Would you mind reading a little bit from when you first got to Berlin?
Oh, sure, yeah. At first, the city seemed to fit the East Block stereotypes I'd grown up with in suburban America. It was the grayest place I'd ever seen, cloudy and cold, shrouded in coal smoke. Add to that the eerie sound of zoo animals howling in the distance and the constant fear sown by rumors of roving gangs of skinheads, and my initial impression of East Berlin was grim. But I quickly discovered a scene exploding with color and creativity behind the dilapidated, shrapnel-pocked facades of the central East Berlin boroughs of Mitte, Prenzlauer Berg, and Friedrichshain. Hidden behind unmarked doors, down ladders and empty lots, nestled among the crumbling bricks of a candlelit basement or a disused cistern, in the attics of half-destroyed buildings, even in abandoned bunkers and bank vaults, a kaleidoscopic new city was taking shape. The bars and clubs that made up this netherworld were dark and dirty, with extension cords meandering down from some distant outlet to power the sound system, and a couple of buckets of water behind the bar providing the only means to wash glasses. They were radically egalitarian, and they were open and welcoming to an outsider like me.
So as you began to research this, were people open? Did they want to tell you their stories?
Yeah, in some ways, I mean, I don't think the book would be possible if I didn't have a long history of some of the people from the scene, because I spent the 90s there in this world with them. But on the other hand, it became, I think, something of an advantage to be an outsider, at least partly an outsider, because there were a lot of people who spoke to me who'd never spoken on the record about their experiences before. There's a number of books in German about the scene. They tend to be pretty insular things. It'll be someone who's part of the scene telling an oral history of the scene in Leipzig, say, or some other city in East Germany. No one had done a narrative history. And I think the fact that I didn't have a shared history with some of the people, particularly a lot of the important women in the story, hadn't spoken to the previous projects. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that once I had their trust and they were confident that my political motives were okay, that I wasn't trying to tell a typical American story, that on the contrary, I was actually trying to make a kind of corrective to the American narrative. Once I had that trust, then I think in some ways it was easier for people to talk to me.
Let's set the stage for folks. Before punk really got hold in East Berlin, it came through British radio. That's how most kids found it. What was life like for a young person, the average person in the GDR?
You know, I think one of the simplest ways to talk about the differences is how the punks saw it. They were sparked by Western radio. Most of them talk about the moment they heard the Sex Pistols on British military radio, for the most part. But it became something really Eastern, really fast. So where the British punks were talking about no future because they didn't see a place for themselves in society because of economic conditions, the punks, as they started to address the conditions in their own lives, they had the exact opposite problem, basically. Their lives were pre-scripted out. They had the communist youth organizations and military training in schools and an apprenticeship and then mandatory military service and then a job in the planned economy that they didn't necessarily have any interest in. So they talked about their problem as too much future, and they wanted to kind of wrest control of the big decisions in their own lives.
So the idea that where punk may have meant something in the United States about pushing back, rebelling against your parents, they were truly pushing back and rebelling against the political systems.
Yeah, although they certainly, most of them had trouble with the parents too. A lot of them ended up having to run away and sort of carving out space to live in these empty buildings. They became really good at carving out sort of physical and philosophical space to enact their ideology.
Was there any particular group or any particular song that became sort of the centerpiece of the movement?
There's a song after, the scene builds slowly from 1977 on. The first punk in East Berlin is generally acknowledged to be a 15-year-old girl who went by the name Major. Mm-hmm. And her first Stasi file was opened before she turned 16.
Explain to people Stasi.
Sorry, the secret police was the Stasi, and they started tailing Major from the time she was about 15 and a half. And eventually she became one of the first punks made an example of. In 1981, she was arrested, thrown in Stasi prison for a year. And then on top of that, she was given what they called the Berlin Verbot for 5 years. So she was shipped out to a town built around a textile mill and expected to work there in the middle of nowhere for the next 5 years, not see her family and friends. She ran away, went back to East Berlin, was rearrested, put back in Stasi prison for another year. And then at the end of that term, they expatriated her. So they shipped her off to West Germany just to take care of the problem. And then for the early 80s, there was a massive crackdown. Some of these bands ended up going to prison for up to 2 years because of their anti-government lyrics. And the hallmark of the scene really was that they would come back out after dealing with the police and the secret police and prison terms and keep fighting. That was the game changer, I think, for the scene. They were able to show, one of the big unknowns was what would happen to you if you ran afoul of the secret police. Mm-hmm. And they basically did the experiment. And they showed that it was possible to resist and survive. They went into jail, they came back out, they kept fighting. And one of the bands that went in and out of jail in 84, they came up with a song that had the lines, "We are the people, we are the power." And that became kind of an anthem inside the scene. And those lines were also then echoed in the street protests in 89 as the mass demonstrations started to snowball and into the scenes that we recognize from late in 89. So it's impossible to say for sure whether that song became the basis of this chant, but there's a pretty good chance. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the punks were on the front lines of the early street protests because they were the ones who lost their fear of the security apparatus.
We're talking to Tim Moore about his book, Burning Down the House, H-A-U-S, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. So, you know, somebody might be listening to this and thinking, why did the secret police, why the Stasi think that kids and music and people dressed, expressing themselves, why is that dangerous? Why would they pay that much attention to them?
That was one of the biggest surprises for me as I started to do the research. You would see right from the start Stasi reports that were unbelievably paranoid about this scene. And I think it was basically, I mean, looking, well, as I got deeper into it, I realized that they were basically correct because they were fearful that the punk scene was pushing kids off this preordained script that they had for them. And it's true, they were. And they were really good at bringing kids to their side. I mean, a lot of it was started out pretty apolitical. It was fun, it was cool, it was daring, something people wanted to get involved in when they saw a punk walk down the street. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the powers of the scene was, unlike some of the other activist groups, or even activist artists who would put a visual piece of visual art or writing out into the world, they would sort of fade back into society as people. The punks expressed opposition every single time they appeared in public.
Because of their appearance,
because
right?
Of their appearance.
Wow. So in terms of what could happen to you, I mean, that's fairly brave. You figure you're going out and you know because of your hairstyle or because of your clothing, you're a target.
I think it's almost impossible to conceive from a Western perspective what they were putting themselves through. Mm-hmm. I mean, the gravity of the situation they were getting into. Although, again, some of them didn't really realize. I guess we'll probably get to this at some point, but most of the concerts took place in churches.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Explain why.
Well, the church had a special status in East Germany. The uniformed security forces couldn't enter churches. So in theory, that meant they could offer a safe space and you could talk about taboo topics inside a church. It didn't always work out that way. In fact, one of these bands, a band called Namenlos, they were sent to prison for 2 years for lyrics of a song that Stasi never found on paper, but it had been overheard by an informant in a church concert. So it wasn't a perfect safe haven, but to an extent. But kids could go to one of these concerts and see a band and go, wow, this is cool, I want to get involved. And because the Eastern media also never recognized dissident activity, a kid could go and try to get involved with the scene, not realizing that the band they'd seen 2 weeks later was picked up and thrown in prison. So in a lot of cases, the kids were coming to it without a full understanding of what they were getting into.
How prevalent were informants?
It was really prevalent, and one of the striking things that they would recruit minors. So there's actually quite a lot of forgiveness within the scene for people who were informants because of the fact that they were so good at profiling people. They were really good at finding people who they could convince. Basically, if you work with us, you're keeping your friends out of prison. You're sparing them a detention or sparing them interrogation. And of course, they could do the opposite as well. If you didn't go along, they would say it would be a shame if your parents lost their jobs or your sister or brother got kicked out of school. So they were really effective at bringing in informants. But there's quite a lot of understanding among people because the Stasi was so good at their jobs. People who got paid for informing, that's a different story. They're still totally ostracized to this day. And actually, the only person who absolutely refused to speak to me for the book was a person who'd sent two of his bandmates to prison by informing.
Wow. So this is the research and the process question I have for you. If this was on the down low and people were, you know, not necessarily writing down lyrics or writing down where they're going to perform because of the fear of getting busted, even though they were, you know, they didn't have fear, but they didn't want, you know, people to be exposed, let's put it that way. How did you research this? How did you get all your information? I know you worked 10 years, but how did you write a narrative nonfiction book? How did you research it?
Well, I thought starting out that the most important resource would be the Stasi records themselves, which are really voluminous and they keep them open to researchers. But a lot of what they collected was pretty mundane. Somebody came out of the door at 8:05, went to the bakery at 8:07, bought two bread rolls, got on the subway at 8:17. You know, it wasn't the kind of material I needed to tell it in the kind of cinematic, fast-paced way I wanted to. So I ended up basically leaning on interviews. But of course, you can cross-check that against the Stasi records too. So the Stasi had great things. They had complete transcripts of interrogations. They would have massive reports on how they had smashed this or that concert or demonstration. But to get the personal aspects of the story, I talked about 50 people, the core people in the scene. And that formed the basis of why it sounds the way it does, the book.
And finally, before I let you go, you said that in an interview recently, this could be a handbook for resistance. How so?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that the situation is a complete analog to other times and places, but they showed opposition-minded people a way forward. And I think one of the things that does translate really well is a phrase they used to spray paint up on walls in East Berlin, and it translated as, "Don't die in the waiting room of the future." And I think it's just a great rallying cry against complacency. You know, you can't sit around and hope change is going to happen. You have to go out and make it. And I think that's really the core of what they were doing.
And that's a point you make in the book, that you see people doing that here in the United States.
Yeah, that was a scary aspect. The research took such a long time that it went from a story that was kind of interesting to me at a personal level to one that was almost eerily relevant. I'm looking at Stasi reports about the surveillance, for instance, and then Snowden comes along with the revelations about the level of mass surveillance here in the States, and I'm reading reports about how they smashed these concerts, and then I look up and you see the response to Black Lives Matter protests and the Dakota Pipeline protests, and yeah, it became, like I said, it was dishearteningly relevant. And then there's one thing that, I mean, it's tough to face, I guess, but people may not understand that unlike our police, the East German cops couldn't just kill people in the streets.
Mm-hmm. And then on a happier note, Legs McNeil likes your book. And he wrote, "Please Kill Me," and he wrote the book, "Please Kill Me." What was that like for you when he said, "Yeah, it's a pretty good book"?
Yeah, the thing for me was I've admired the people in this book for such a long time, ever since I first started to meet people from the scene back in the early 90s. And for them to be recognized by a figure like Legs, I mean, because obviously he's a legend to them as well. that felt great to see the look on there. A few of them came over for the launch event, and to see the look on the face when Legs started talking about how important their story was and how courageous these people were, that was a really special moment.
Book's getting great reviews. Congratulations to you, Tim Moore. The name of it is Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Thanks for joining us on All of It.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on All of It, a new play looks at the life of Gloria Steinem. Christine Lotti has stepped into the role. We'll talk to her about embodying Gloria Steinem, and we'll talk with the play's writer and director as well. All of It will be back after a quick break.
WNYC supporters include Sanford L. Smith & Associates, presenting the Salon Art and Design, with 56 international dealers exhibiting art and design from 1890 to the present. Open now through Monday at the Park Avenue Armory. More at thesalonny.com. Bryant University, for 155 years, dedicated to educating and inspiring students to excel as they become innovative leaders of character prepared to make a difference around the world. Learn more at bryant.edu. New York City Center, at the Center of the Arts for 75 years, presenting A Chorus Line for 7 performances only, November 14th through 18th. Tickets and more information at nyctycenter.org.
I'm Gene Demby from NPR's Code Switch team. We're a podcast about race and identity. You know, easy, fun stuff to talk about. On Friday, November 16th, we'll be live at Harlem's world-famous Apollo Theater. It's part of the Work It Festival from WNYC Studios. We're hanging out with Marcus Samuelson, the celebrity chef who started Red Rooster in Harlem, plus some dope beats from the percussionist and composer Bobby Sanabria. You can get your tickets at workitevents.com. That's WERKIT events.com.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Writer and activist Gloria Steinem has dedicated her life to championing the rights of women. And some pretty incredible women have gotten together to tell the story of Gloria's life in a new play called Gloria a Life. It's written by Tony Award nominee Emily Mann. Hi, Emily. And it's directed by Tony Award winner Diane Paulus. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
And it features an all-female cast led by Academy, Golden Globe, and Emmy Award-winning actor and filmmaker Christine Lotti. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Gloria a Life is playing at the Darryl Roth Theater through March 31st, and we're so happy to have you all in the studio.
Wonderful to be here.
Thank you.
It's really interesting. I'm going to describe the play for folks so we can all get on the same page. So the first part of the play is a description of Gloria's life, of her heroes, her mentors, the way she grows up. And then the second part, grows up as a little kid and as a woman. And the second part of the play, Act Two, is a talk back with the audience where people get to share their stories, their feelings about what's going on. So Emily, as you started to write this play and you decided on your structure, you know, it's not strictly chronological. Mm-hmm. How did you decide how are you? We're going to structure it. I guess it's a very basic question.
Yes.
How do you balance biography with the need to tell a story?
Well, that's such a good question because, of course, that was the struggle all the way through. I knew from the beginning that it was going to feel like a talking circle because that's the central image for Gloria's life and her life in activism. So I always knew there was going to be an act two. I always knew that there was going to be not the usual theater talk back, but in fact, a talking circle. And it was really once I met with Diane and she embraced that and she understood that it wasn't going to be ordinary that she actually designed the entire production around that idea. So we are sitting in a circle for the entire show. The whole show is a talking circle. And then it just goes into the next phase in act two. And it seems quite organic to everything that I'd ever hoped for. So that was wonderful. In terms of telling the story, it's a long, rich life.
Mm-hmm.
So choosing what those stories were and how to sort of string the string of pearls, if you will, of, you know, each pearl being a story was part of the challenge. We sometimes call each other the dream team because the three of us just sort of have a mind meld and we always just take the best idea in the room. It actually is almost the same stories told in the same order as when I started and went with my impulses, but then how to activate it, how to make it theater, how to make it true to Christine, how to make, you know, and there's no one on earth who shapes space better than the director Diane Paulus mm-hmm. in terms of theater. So with that in mind, we work to go from a one-woman play into a play with a cast of seven and make it highly theatrical. I didn't really answer your question, but I tried.
Well, you know, you did. You said you had to pick and choose, mm-hmm. and then you knew you were going to have this other aspect, this intimate mm-hmm. aspect. Mm-hmm. And Diane, that comes to you. You know, Pippin was big and splashy and hair, and this is really intimate and small. How do you keep interest and pace when you're dealing with one person? It's an ensemble, but Christine's on stage the whole time. In such a small room where we can all see each other, it's like there's nowhere to hide and there's nowhere to get lost in the fantasy, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yes, mm-hmm. I think I'm always interested in community. You know, that's one of my driving passions in the theater, whether it's a company doing acrobatics and Pippin or Catfish Row and Porgy and Bess, mm-hmm. or in this case, as Emily mentioned, moving the show from the idea of we're going to tell one woman's life to say, you know, what is the community that has been Gloria's life? And I think dramaturgically, mm-hmm. that was so important from the get-go, that in actually to be true to Gloria Steinem's life, we needed to talk about other people, because that's the theme in her life. Mm-hmm. What she has facilitated for other people and how she's been inspired by other women. So it's quite critical that there are six women surrounding Christine the whole night, and they play, I don't know, 100 different roles. They switch from a cab driver to Bella Abzug to Dorothy Pittman Hughes to Flo Kennedy to Wilma Mankiller. You know, they're taking on all these little roles and all these big roles, all these kind of muses and mentors that were critical to Gloria. And then for me, the metaphor was the audience. It continues. The circle continues to the audience. So it feels intimate because it's 300 people total in one room. But actually, for me, this show felt epic. Yes. You know, as complicated as musicals are, this one was really complicated because we're covering so much history, so much time. Right. We're doing it in an hour and a half. And my goal as the director was to make everyone have space to say, that's my life. That's where I was. That's where I remember my mother. That's where I connect. Oh, and that's what I missed, and now I'm feeling this. You know, that's mm-hmm. trying to make the audience feel like they are part of the story. And then literally we do that in Act Two, where the audience is invited to share their stories.
And Christina, when I saw it the other night, and Gloria Steinem came out for the talkback, we'll talk about that in a minute, and you made the point that, you know, you didn't want to do an impersonation, mm. you didn't want to do an impression, but you know, you're an actress, you have to embody this person, mm. you have to let us, the audience, know about her life. How did you go about that?
Well, my focus was obviously on her emotional journey. And I kept trying to get to the darker underbelly of Gloria, because we all know about the icon. And, you know, a friend recently said, you know, basically, Christine, you're playing Jesus. but I said, no, I'm not. I'm playing a human being. And Gloria was completely enthusiastic and embracing of this idea, which is to be as honest as she could be about her life, warts and all, in order to inspire others to accept their own imperfections, because we all are, you know, our full humanity is what we should celebrate. Mm-hmm. And that's what Gloria stands for. And so she was, although she is, you know, she can be a little guarded. It was like all of us were, okay, tell us, go deeper. And she was so willing to do that. So that was my focus was, I want to tell a story of a flawed, complex, brilliant human being. And starting from when she was completely unwoke, mm-hmm. and the way the complex relationship she had with her mother, and this, to me, she was a woman who grew up feeling like she didn't matter, her mother didn't matter, who evolved into a woman who was determined to make sure all women mattered. And that drive, that emotional drive, is what to me fuels the journey of the play.
That's right.
And the story of her yeah. mother is one I don't think a lot of people know, that her mother had been a journalist and had written under a man's name and yeah. then wasn't able to fulfill her life and her potential, and she began to lose her mind.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Gloria was her caregiver. And that was a really, I don't think I knew that part of the story.
I know, at the age of 10.
Yeah.
Well, she, you know, in the play, Christine says, as Gloria, you know, she had what was in those days called a nervous breakdown.
Right.
You yeah. know, but the point really that I think we make through the play is that it wasn't a personal fate. Christine should quote the line. What is the line?
Well, you wrote it.
For the Gloria said it. Yeah. It wasn't a personal fault. It was a female fate.
A female fate.
Yeah. Yeah. And when she used to, she wrote a beautiful piece called Ruth, about her mother, and a song, Ruth's song, because she couldn't sing it. And often she'd be asked on the road, well, are you afraid of inheriting your mother's illness? And she said, well, only if patriarchy is inherited. Right? She knew that her mother was broken, that it was not that she had a breakdown, as one thinks of now in terms of brain chemistry and all of that. It really was that she was crushed. She was stopped from having the life she wanted to have. And when you understand that being at the core, then it becomes really clear what this is. But Gloria wanted this. She, one of the impulses she had for having the play done at all was she said, look, if I didn't get woke until I was 35, and if I had the childhood I had and could still make a difference and somehow work to help others, you can do it too. She wanted to be able to inspire others through her story.
Yeah, you all mentioned Gloria. How involved was she in
Very.
Your part of the production, Emily, in the last song, you two? Yeah. In your terms of your part of the part of writing it, did she express to you themes she wanted?
Yeah.
Did you have to point out to her like things that would work on stage that, while might be dear to her, not necessarily would work on a play?
We talked it all through. I mean, right from the beginning, we started with my saying, do you mind if I actually do an old-fashioned interview and do it not the way you've been interviewed a million other times, but just through, you know, free associations that I might have a real conversation, and she was so game for it. So right from the get-go, we had two straight days of just talking with the tape recorder on.
What were you trying to get out of that interview, sort of not that not traditional format?
Well, I do so much documentary playwriting, right? So I wanted to see if a form would reveal itself through our discussions. I had that with the Delaney sisters, too, when I did Having Our Say. Once I spoke to them, I realized, oh, this is the play. It came really quickly to me because I'd had that experience of them telling me right off the bat what they wanted to tell. And it was interesting, the stories that Gloria led with, and they are the key stories in the play to this day. So I wanted to get past what happens, you know, with the great documentaries done about her and the interviews about her, but to try to just get to her on an emotional level. And that, so she's been fantastic all the way through. It's been 4 years since we started.
Wow. Yeah.
And she's also so great and smart because she'll really defer to the theatrical process.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, she was so, eager to be there to help us, but really saying, you know, this is your area.
Yeah.
You know, you show me how this can be made into theater. Mm-hmm. But it was so great to have her because we'd be sitting in rehearsal and we'd be working on a section, as Emily said, you know, mind meld, something on the page, something I was trying, something Christine was wrestling with, and we'd be like, well, should we just go text Gloria?
Right.
Text her, or Christine would say, I'll email her, and then the next day a response would come in. So we'd get information. There were lines that would come in the next morning from Gloria that would then go into the play. It was really an amazing process.
Yeah. She's also, sorry.
I was like, she's a journalist, so I'm sure she was curious about the process. What kind of questions did she have for you?
I think she wanted to know about editing. You know, as you said, she's a fierce editor, right? And so I think what was a learning curve was that, you know, in the theater, you edit in space. So you do your first round of editing on the page, but it's not done when it's on the page. So you go as far as you can on the page, but then really, things that don't even look like they're going to work on the page work in space through actors, through time, through music, through all these things with a light cue shift. Mm-hmm. So I think, some of it was just going back and forth to say, well, leave that with me because I think I know how to do that in time and space with theater, you know, and once we get into the actors. So I think it was just extending that editing process to, you know, live theater.
Christine, when you put on, you got the look. when you get the full costuming on, the costuming is really great. Can you tell me about the way you studied Gloria physically so that you could telegraph to people what was going on with her emotionally through your physical actions?
Yeah, I mean, we've been friends for many, many, many years. So that was another, I think, asset to our collaboration was that I remember a story she told me 15 years ago, and maybe we should put that in the play. And Yeah, we're very close, and we connect emotionally on so many levels. We have had similar relationships with our mothers, although my mother was not did not have an anxiety disorder, but she was broken. I think her spirit was broken mm-hmm. by the patriarchy. And also being from the Midwest and being, there's just a lot of emotional connections. Being activists, of course, she is way in another stratosphere mm-hmm. compared to my activism. But physically, I just, you know, after I got the part, I decided to first, I always work internally first to find what the emotional connections are. And then very last bit is to add in the physical changes, the adjustments. And that's when I went out to dinner with her and just watched her. I said, I'm going to watch the way you eat your food, the way you wipe your mouth.
Enjoy your meal, but yeah. I'm watching you.
What every friend wants, right?
Yeah. Relax. I'm only going to be copying every single move that you make. The way she walked. I mean, it was kind of also
Her hands.
I mean, she's like yes. a conductor. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful. My nails are as long as they can possibly be, but this is unusual for me. But her hands are like, yeah, she conducts the air. She just is magic with her hands. So that's been a wonderful thing to do. And then the walk has just kind of evolved because I just know her and I just have watched her.
It's interesting that you have, it's great that you have an all-female ensemble, an all-female group. Last night did a talk back with the woman who produced the RBG documentary.
Ah.
And she ended up with an all-female crew, a DP, yeah. editor. And I asked her, you know, what was different? And she said, you know, it's just, we got along. Like you just covered your mouth and laughed.
Yeah.
What do you think, having worked with this female group, what does she mean? Dude, that struck a chord with you, Emily.
Oh, it absolutely did. Well, we laugh about this all the time because we talk about there was no ego in the room.
Zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just, you know, you take the best idea and you run with it. And whatever comes in, you know, you're not afraid to be wrong. You're not, you know, no one says it was their idea and they're right. Mm-hmm. It's just you're looking for the best moment, the best idea to make the work at its highest and level, and you know, so you're not jockeying with people's egos and with people's, you know, and need for ownership. And you know, I'm sure there are many men who work that way too.
I just haven't met them either.
But we had one of the glorious ones, and also it was true of the entire ensemble.
Yeah, yeah. And it was intergenerational, which I think was really special. That mm-hmm. I mean, I always get into this as a director, that the process of creation of the work kind of mimics what you're actually, the story you're telling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was really important that, you know, the talking circle that was the play in Emily's brain that went on the page became the show was actually replicated in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So there were many moments in the rehearsal where we just stopped and we just had a talking circle. Because Emily's had certain experiences, Christine, I've had, and then we had generations down to, I think our youngest member had just graduated, an intern in the room had just graduated high school.
Wow. Oh,
so it was like sharing across generations of, well, this is how it felt to me when I was in school. Oh, I've never heard, really that? And it was happening in the room. And I think all of that actually affects the creation, and you start to feel that. It's the unspoken, but it's held in the air in the play.
And also the women of color in our ensemble, they contributed so much.
Yes, because absolutely. That's the point, that this is not Gloria Steinem, one woman. It is really about a larger idea. And for her, one of the stories of the play, one of the themes is how inspired she was by women of color mm-hmm. and the kind of intersectional aspect of feminism that...
Before we knew that's what it...
Before,
people
yes,
would recognize
exactly.
It as such,
before,
right?
Before that label was on it, that was really... You know, where she started in her feminism.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Emily Mann, Diane Paulus, and Christine Lotti about Gloria Steinem, A Life. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Yeah. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're back with Christine Lotti. She stars as Gloria Steinem in the new play, Gloria Life. Joining us as well as playwright Emily Mann and the show's director, Diane Paulus. All right, let's talk about Act Two. This is the second part of the interview, the talk back. It's really, the house lights come up. You know, New York audiences aren't necessarily famous for wanting to get involved, necessarily. Christine, tell me a little bit about trying to get the audience to open up initially.
Yeah, well, the question I ask, we have special guests most of the time, and Gloria is one of them, often. Mm-hmm. But what we try to ask is, how did the story we told tonight resonate with your own personal story, and that keeps it on a kind of personal level. Mm-hmm. And then often there's a few moments of just complete silence, and either I'll jump in, or Gloria will jump in, or whoever the guest will jump in. But then it starts to want the one brave person. The other night was a 14-year-old girl who was the bravest. She just stood up and said, I've learned so much from this play, mm-hmm. and I want you to know that there's hope, because I'm going to carry in front of the marches. And last night there was a young boy of color in a high school, and he stood up and he said, this play has changed me into an activist. I never knew that I had a voice, and I never knew that I could actually affect change, but now I'm going to, from now on, I'm going to start doing some outrageous acts in the cause of social justice. So it's been amazing. I mean, that's been one of the most gratifying parts of doing this play.
Do you all have any that are your favorite people who stood up and said something?
You know, it's terrifying every night, because it truly, you really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you just like, is the thing ends and you're like, what's going to happen tonight? Fasten your seatbelt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always talk about this one. There was one woman who talked about being a Pan Am stewardess in the 70s and all that came with that.
The other night there was a woman who said she was the first one stewardess to have Ms.
Yes.
On her wings.
Yes.
I know. A lot of people talk about that. Yeah. They say there was a school teacher who petitioned to be called Ms. in the letter she had to write. But the stewardess said, I was a stewardess. I never thought I could be a pilot. I never thought I could, accomplish what men accomplish. But then I finally went back to school and I got my PhD in reproductive physiology or something like that. And I contributed to the book, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Does anybody know it? And so many women were like, the Bible. But you hear so many stories. And then there's another person who started that chapter of Now in Memphis, Tennessee, and another lawyer who's done work for disabled people for 30 years. And you just mm-hmm. appreciate. I mean, we're all in the theater. But then, you get that town hall in Act Two, and you see there's so many people who are just fighting in the trenches. It's really encouraging.
And then also the men. I'm very moved by the men. I remember one night where a man he looked like he was going to start sobbing, and he actually said, I don't know if you know how much pain we're in, because we want to be your allies, and mm-hmm. we know we can't live, and we don't know exactly what you go through because we can't be you, but I want to be there for you, and I know so many of us do. And Gloria was there, and she said, I want to give a big hand to all the men who are here tonight. Yeah. We love the support. We're so happy that you're hearing these stories and that you're here with us. And I just wanted to bring that out, because so many people think, oh, this is just a women's evening.
Yeah.
And it really isn't. And the young people are also so thrilling. And sometimes you'll see a mother-daughter combination. And one of the daughter said to her mother, oh, I had no idea. I just took for granted everything that I have. And I want to thank you for all the work that you did. I mean, so there's just great healing going on.
And then
on.
There have been lots of people who say, oh my God, I can't go on. I'm so depressed.
Yes,
I've lost
hope.
But then usually the beautiful thing is that, where are the Bella Abzugs of today? Mm-hmm. They just don't exist. They're disheartened. And then usually Christine will say, is there any young person in the room? And then she does these great prompts. And then, always a young person will put their hand up and say, I'm here and I'm not giving up. And I see the Bella Abzugs all around me.
I thought about Rebecca Traister.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Gloria Steinem wrote for New York Magazine.
Yep.
And then I thought about Rebecca Traister's new book, Good and Mad. I was maybe that's her role. I just thought it was interesting, the parallel. And I also wanted to ask about this must be a really interesting time to be putting on this play this fall.
Oh my God.
With everything that's been, what have the waves been like over the course of the run, Christine?
Well, certainly during the Kavanaugh hearing, it was a lot of sobbing and despair and hopelessness. And then after the midterms the other day, there's been a slight bump up of more hope. But as Gloria says, even in despair, you can take all that rage and despair and put it into activism. And she's such a hopeaholic, self-proclaimed. And she talks about the ways in which you can channel that energy, and that it's so important to have the tears and have the rage, but then now, next morning, do something about it. Like, mm-hmm. even if it's as simple as having a weekly meeting with your friends, men and women who love women, and just talk about what's going on, tell your stories, and then what to do about it.
Yeah. It was so interesting to watch. I think I saw it the night of the midterms. And do you ad-lib the beginning?
Emily.
You really get together and write it?
Oh, yes. Emily gave me the lines, I think, just about an hour before the show.
Uh-huh.
So I was back there like, oh, God. And I actually had it in my back pocket in case I forgot it. I had it written down. So I just, and then the other night I stumbled over because I couldn't remember where we were in the writing. But I think that'll stick now for a while.
I hope so. It was a little later than usual because I was waiting to hear from, usually when we get these ideas, you know, we're right on the phone with each other or we're emailing each other immediately. But somehow Gloria was booked that morning and so was Diane. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at my watch and said, there's a matinee. I called Christina and said, well, here's what I've got. Let's talk it through.
It's amazing. I mean, just like this is live radio, right? We're in a live art form.
Yeah. That's what I thought. It's a living, breathing thing.
And we said to the cast right off the bat, you know, we are going to be changing this. And that's mm-hmm. the beauty of this theatrical convening that we're making, that the lines can change and mm-hmm. we will respond and continue to respond mm-hmm. between now and, you know, March. There's going to be more changes to come, I'm sure.
Yeah,
and there's something very special about looking directly at the audience, which is so unusual for me and was a big challenge for me first, because I usually like to block out. I don't ever want to see any face. I just want to be in the moment with the other actor. But this is story theater. This is mm-hmm. storytelling.
And you make eye contact. At one point, I was like, oh gosh, sorry.
But I'm starting to be able to use the audience's reaction. Mm-hmm. Like if I see a woman and she's got tears in her eyes, that just feeds me so much.
They're your scene partner.
They're my scene partner, exactly. Yeah. And that was Diane's gift, was just use them as your scene partner, because they were always my enemy. I don't want that intrusion. But this was such a different form of theater that I've never done before. And now I'm so grateful, except if I see somebody like falling asleep, that's not helpful.
What would Gloria do? Just saw somebody falling asleep at one of her rallies. She'd have a line.
Exactly. Or just talk really loudly.
Or just give them their space. You know, maybe they're just taking a pause.
We all take things in different ways.
Yes. Exactly.
Ladies, thank you so much for coming down to the studio. This was really fun.
Thank you.
Emily Mann, Diane Paulus, and Christine Lottie. The name of the play is Gloria Steinem, Gloria, A Life, and it's playing through March at the Darryl Roth Theater in Union Square. We'll be right back. Now is the time of the week on All of It, and we try to help you sort through what's happening around town. We all know New York has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to cultural events, and that's where our colleague Charlie Herman comes in. It's Charlie for the Culture. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, Allison. How are you?
I'm good. How great was that about Gloria Steinem?
That fantastic.
Yeah,
just to see
awesome.
that combination of women there.
So what do you have? I'm going to a museum this weekend, according to you.
Yeah, I think that the one that you really cannot avoid, that you really have to put on your list of places to go to, is this new exhibit. It is a retrospective of Andy Warhol that is at the Whitney. It's called From A to B and Back Again. It is a huge show. It's the largest retrospective of his work since 1989. This is a big show at the Whitney as well, too. There are more than 350 works. There's paintings, there's drawings, there's prints, there's movies, there's photos. There is a lot to see here. In fact, this is the largest exhibition that the Whitney has dedicated to one artist since they've moved to the new building in the Meatpacking District.
So I have two things to tell you. One, we had Paula Cooper in here, and she was just very Paula Cooper and cool character. And I said, what show have you seen that you liked? And she went, Warhol! And
Warhol.
She put her hands down. Now, you know, I think everyone thinks, I've seen what Andy Warhol has to offer. This obviously has more, right?
It does. And I think that you may think, oh, I know him. I know what his work is. But I would ask you, do you really? I mean, a lot of his work is recognizable. He is recognizable with his silver wig. Mm-hmm. I mean, he himself was as much a personality as a lot of the art that we know about him. But I think what is good about this show is it really probes. I mean, it is a true retrospective. It is probing all of his work and really looking seriously at it and asking you as a viewer to consider it seriously. You know, look past just the Marilyn Monroe pictures, mm-hmm. and the Elizabeth Taylor. Those are really important, but it doesn't dwell on them. They are there, but they're put in a context that is much larger. You know, one of the things to keep in mind is that the 1989 retrospective that happened 2 years after his death,
right,
in 1987 was at MoMA, and two-thirds of that exhibit focused on the part that we know the most, the pictures of Marilyn Monroe or Jackie Onassis. So in a way, this is trying to give you a I don't want to say it's a corrective, but the totality of his work and what a serious artist he really was.
So some of the darker aspects of his work, I understand, are featured in the exhibit.
It is, because I think, you know, when you see the images of Marilyn Monroe, for example, he did that after she passed away. Mm-hmm. The images of Liz Taylor were done at a time when she was going through a lot of crisis. You know, he has this series of portraits of Jackie Onassis. Like, there is a pop element. We recognize the image. These are people, part of our culture. Mm-hmm. But he's also sort of mining some of the darker stuff. And there's a whole series of works that he did that were called Death and Disaster.
Wow.
It features, car crashes, a woman who committed suicide, who landed on top of a limousine, and you sort of see, it becomes this sort of weird, almost abstract kind of image. One of the most powerful images, I think, in the whole show that I saw is one that's called Lavender Disaster. It is, mm-hmm. an electric chair that is from Sing Sing, and it's this huge work that has sort of a lavender color over it. It's repeated, but it just has this power of, here's this lone image that has, you know, this contrast between a really beautiful color and what it's actually talking about. Hmm. So, you know, this theme kind of goes through there. And keep in mind, he also survived an assassination attempt at one point. So, you know, it's really asking you to reconsider and rethink who Andy Warhol is as an artist, was as an artist, and his impact. And I think a show that does that is a really good show. It makes you consider, mm-hmm. it more. There's a whole film series that's happening tied into the exhibit as well.
Oh, of course.
And then there's also a section that is just a lot of his celebrity images. And those are great to see. You know, I think my favorite was the Dolly Parton image. It's just a great one.
How could it not be your favorite?
How could it not be your favorite?
All right, let's talk about another event. You're recommending listeners go to the Chamber Music Society.
I think what's really nice about this is the Chamber Music Society, you know, they're in the midst of their season. They perform at Alice Tully Hall. And the thing that they really do for the group is that they really curate a program. So for each one that comes up, there's a theme that goes through it. And there's one that's coming up on Tuesday that has to do with a work of art by Schubert that's commonly known as The Trout. It is a very uplifting, the whole program is a very uplifting, you know, sort of pleasurable experience. And I think really in the moment that we're in right now, mm-hmm. after this week, after what we've gone through, to have those moments of joy and lightness and beauty is a wonderful thing.
Should we play a little bit of it?
I think we should.
I see why you brought this to us.
It's you know, the thing about The Trout is Schubert had written a song that was based on a poem about a trout and a fisherman, and spoiler alert, it does not end well for the fish. But it was a very popular song, and the story goes that when he was about 22 years old, this is about in the early 1800s, he was with a friend outside of Vienna during the summer, and a wealthy amateur musician had asked him, can you take this little song that you wrote and make a chamber piece for me? And this is a 5-member chamber piece. It was not something that was meant to be performed in concert halls. And it is a, you know, you have a violin, a viola, a cello, mm-hmm. a double bass, and the performance that's happening at the Chamber Music Society is featuring this young virtuoso double bass player named Xavier Foley. It is just a lovely performance, and it is just a lovely piece of work. I saw this tied into a new dance performance that was premiered back in the summer with Mark Morris. And I have to say, when I work now, I listen to it constantly.
Aww.
Because it's just something, it's great and it gets you in the mood and it's just a lovely piece of work.
Well, I have something for you.
Uh-oh.
Someone I know, a friend, has an art show that's closing this month and I wanted to tell you about it. It's called Strange Roots and it's the Burning and Water Art Gallery in West Chelsea. And he's an interesting guy. I'll tell you about the exhibit first and then I'll tell you his backstory. So he wanted to figure out how algorithms really influence who we are and what we like and computer algorithms.
Right.
So he was looking up about beauty and everything he came back from him, because he's a tall, handsome white guy, that everything that came back about beauty came back through the lens of whiteness. He couldn't, no matter how he typed it in, he couldn't figure out how to make the algorithm give him something different, some other aspect of beauty. So what he did is he took some of these images and he transposed them onto different medium, and then there's also blown glass, and he's made these sculptures, and then he's also put in roots of the trees and branches and beautiful flowers. He's trying to get this idea. He wanted to form what he called fruits, these different fruits that will look the different ways that we should be thinking about diversity of beauty.
What's super interesting about that right now is, and this is one that blew my mind about a year or so ago, learning that so many of the sculptures that you see from ancient mm-hmm. Greece and Rome, they were painted. They were not white that we see them now. And this concept of what is beauty and how things can be transmitted to you without even realizing what is happening there.
Yeah, and how it keeps us in our tribes and how it keeps us reinforcing certain images. So his name is Jesse Crimes, and it's called Strange Roots. It's burning an art gallery. The interesting thing about Jesse spent 6 years in prison. And during that time in prison, he had gotten busted for selling drugs. He used his art to maintain his humanity and to keep himself out of trouble with all the prison culture. He's gone on to get a Rauschenberg Fellowship. He's part of the Aggie Gun Justice Fellowship. It's just an interesting story, but this show is really great because it's really just about his art and his moving forward as an artist. So you should go see it.
Allison Stewart, thanks so much for hosting.
Charlie Herman, thanks for your tips. Everybody, have a great weekend. You've been listening to All of It on WNYC.